So tonight is kind of an odd topic. We could call it group loyalty or being part of a tribe, something like that. And the reason I'm talking about this topic, this is the third in a series of three talks. I was intrigued a few weeks ago when I was reading some research about moral rules throughout the world. And it turns out that, and this is something that's been verified several times in research, that if you look at moral systems throughout the world, all moral rules can be classified into, you might call them, five basic buckets. One bucket is about showing care and not harming. One bucket is about fairness. One is about respecting authority. One is about purity. And one is about group loyalty. And it turns out in America that liberals, on average, tend to put a lot of importance on the first two and kind of blow off the other three. And conservatives kind of value all five equally. And so right away, you can see ways that each one would look at the other and say, well, you're not being moral enough, you know, this sort of thing. And so it just got me interested in exploring these other three dimensions. You know, I don't think I have to convince people in Berkeley much that fairness is important or that compassion is important, you know. But what about these other dimensions? And this one was particularly interesting for me because it's clear looking at Buddhism that there are roles of authority, at least in some branches of Buddhism. And it's very clear also that purity is an idea. It's very easy to see how you could interpret purity from a Buddhist perspective. But when I first thought about this, I thought group loyalty. Buddhism is about universal acceptance, universal compassion. You know, how on earth am I going to talk about group loyalty being consistent with universal compassion? And so my first impulse was maybe I should just skip this topic, you know. But then I thought about it some more. It certainly is true that groups play an important part in our life. That groups of friends, that tribes, that communities are very important and in fact always have been important in human evolution. In fact, it goes way, way back. If you think about the grand picture of evolution, most mammals have, you know, groups or packs or tribes. You know, they're called different things for different animals. Birds also, many of them, you know, the old saying, birds of a feather flock together. Even ants are social. And so this is something that goes deep, deep back in the roots of evolution. And there's clear evolutionary reasons why. There's all kinds of advantages that an individual in a group has that the isolated individual would not have, you know. And so it's very easy to see why evolution would have selected for this over the course of hundreds of millions of years. And so here we are, the products of evolution. And, you know, we have these warm mammalian brains that like things warm and fuzzy, and you know, we're kind of designed to connect with others. And so it's actually part of who we are to connect with groups. And we get a lot of benefit from groups, and certainly some of it is practical. Just in terms of very, you know, monetary or whatever. Some of it is certainly the emotional support we get from being around people where we really feel part of a tribe. And there's really mystical aspects to it also. I mean, in many ways, a sangha is a kind of tribe. It's a kind of spiritual tribe. It was interesting to me. I have a good friend, he's a colleague of mine, he's a very intelligent guy, and he started to get into meditating, and he was asking me some questions about it because he knows I'm into it. And one thing I said was, it's more powerful when you meditate in a group than when you meditate on your own. And that's been my experience throughout my life. And he said, well, why is that? you know, and he's thinking about it rationally. Like, why is it? If you're all sitting there in silence, why on earth would it be more powerful, you know? But there is something more powerful, and it's hard to say what that is even. You know, is there some kind of energetic resonance between people? Is, you know, could social psychologists explain it some way? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. But it seems that this the power of groups operates at several different levels. And so I would say, on the one hand, there's nothing wrong with having a tribe. There's nothing wrong with valuing what being part of a group has to offer in any context in life. But the problem comes in the relationship of inside and outside. And it's really analogous in many ways to an individual. You know, it's fine if I'm enjoying my life or I'm, you know, I have a good opinion of myself. But if part of that is I need to have a bad opinion about other people, you see, that's where the problem would be. Or if I'm walking around thinking I'm spiritual, but I'm actually rubbing people the wrong way and they're thinking I'm an actual jerk, you know, that sort of thing. That's the problem. You know, it's not only what is my experience of myself, but what kind of impact am I having around me? And much the same with a group. And so I think what's problematic about groups is when they get into this mindset of we have something special and the people on the outside don't have it. Or we're the good people and the people on the outside are the bad people. And there's so much of this in human history, and there's so much in the ways that you know humans have related to each other along racial lines, along ethnic lines, along national lines, with this profound othering. We are the true humans, and those others, they're somehow less than human or not human. This sort of thing. I remember hearing a few different times that when a war is going on, it's really part of the indoctrination of soldiers to experience a profound othering of the enemy, that they have to think of the enemy as unhuman or less than human or monsters or something like that, because if they have the awareness that these other people are human beings exactly like me, it makes it that much harder. Like, no emotionally healthy person is going to want to shoot at that person, you know? And so it's a very, very tricky thing. And I'd say in many ways, you might say that the Sangha is a kind of, it's almost an ideal of what a group could be, you know? Ideally the nature of a Sangha is that, first of all, it's open and inclusive. If other people want to come, you know, if they want to be a member, fine. It's ridiculous to think that, you know, Sanghas are going to get into this, you know, like we're holier than the other Sangha, you know, like any kind of competitive thing or that sort of thing. There's much more an air of respect, at least ideally. You know, I'm sure that in the history of Buddhism, there certainly have been rivalries and things like this. And so it's very interesting just to think about the groups that we're in and what are the qualities of the groups. Are the groups that we're in what ways do they support us? In what ways do they hold us back? This might be groups of friends, this might be people we work with, this might be family, you know. What are the strengths that we get from them? What are the benefits we get from them? And do we fully appreciate everything we get from them, on the one hand? And, you know, what are the ways that we might have to grow beyond the group, you know? And so, all interesting questions just to think about. As usual, I prepared a quote sheet. Created an expectation here. So I have two quotes from the Christian Bible here. One are just words from Jesus from the Gospel of Matthew. "For wherever two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst of them." And just this idea that when people are gathering together for the sake of connecting spiritually, that there's some greater presence that develops among them, even if it's only two or three of them, that there's just this, there's something powerful about that intention of meeting to connect or commune in this authentic spiritual way. And this other fascinating one from the Gospel of Luke. John said, "Master, we saw a man casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him, because he does not follow with us. But Jesus said to him, 'Do not forbid him, for he who is not against you is for you.'" And this whole idea that, you know, I love this idea that the apostles, they were getting worried, like they almost wanted to trademark this Jesus thing, and they're worried about some other group. And the way that Jesus just completely, you know, destroys that notion, like, you don't have a corner on the market here, you know. And you know, explodes the idea of this exclusivity. And then from the Buddhist writings, the Upadhasutta, this is from the Pali Canon, the original writings of Buddhism, their venerable Ananda, who was the successor of the successor of the Buddha. So the successor of the Buddha was Kashyapa, and then Ananda was the second in that line. The venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "This is half of the holy life, Lord, admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie." "Do not say that, Ananda," this is the Buddha responding. "Don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable comradeship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk has admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path." And this whole idea that having the energy of the Sangha, having the noble people around you, is enough to foster your spiritual growth. Then a variety of quotes here. Just an African proverb that I love. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with others. That one is beautiful. From Ibsen, "A community is like a ship. Everyone ought to be prepared to take the helm." From the amazing Catholic social worker, Dorothy Day, "We have all known the long loneliness, and we have found that the answer is community." And it is one of these funny things. America is so much about the individual and being the individual, and I get to do my thing. And it's like sometimes America gets so caught in the, you know, I need to do my thing, that we actually forget that we need each other, that we need community, you know. From Thich Nhat Hanh, who's still with us, "A Sangha is a community of friends practicing the Dharma together in order to bring about and maintain awareness. The essence of a Sangha is awareness, understanding, acceptance, harmony, and love. When you do not see these in a community, it is not a true Sangha, and you should have the courage to say so. But when you find these elements are present in a community, you know that you have the happiness and fortune of being in a real Sangha." From the amazing woman Coretta Scott King, "The greatness of a community is most accurately measured by the compassionate actions of its members." From E.O. Wilson, the scientist who studied ants quite a bit, It's always been a great survival value for people to believe that they belong to a superior tribe. That's just in human relationships." A touching one from Stanislav Grof, "Dying people in pre-industrial cultures typically died in the context of an extended family, a clan, or a tribe." really the worst thing that could happen in a traditional society is that you would die alone, and yet that's such an American thing now, you know? Henry Nouwen said, "Solitude is very different from a time out from our busy lives. Solitude is the very ground from which community grows. Whenever we pray alone, study, read, write, or simply spend quiet time away from the places where we interact with others directly, we are potentially open for a deeper intimacy with each other." And so really, I love that sort of dialogue between being alone and nurturing oneself in aloneness, and then, as it were, cultivating the gifts that one brings back to the community. From Nikki Rowe, "If they criticize you before they cheer you on, they are not your people. Simple." From Marion Williamson, "People crave comfort, people crave connection, people crave community." From the Zen teacher Sharon Salzberg, "We need to redefine community and find a variety of ways of coming together and helping each other." From the neurobiologist Steven Pinker, "If you aren't brought up in your tribe but interact with other people either directly or vicariously through journalism or literature, you see what life is like from other points of view and are less likely to demonize them or dehumanize them and are more likely to empathize with them." So this whole idea that, say, literature or even journalism has the power to open us up and open our sense of tribe much larger, you know, so that our sense of us and who our people are is much wider. From Seth Godin, "A tribe is a group of people connected to one another, connected to a leader, and connected to an idea. For millions of years, human beings have been part of one tribe or another. A group needs only two things to be a tribe: a shared interest and a way to communicate." And this fascinating one from Sebastian Younger, who's a journalist who's gone to war several times. "I know what coming back to America from a war zone is like because I've done it so many times. First, there's a kind of shock at the comfort and affluence that we enjoy, but that is followed with the dismal realization that we live in a society that is basically at war with itself. People speak with incredible contempt about, depending on their views, the rich, the poor, the educated, the foreign-born, the president, or the entire U.S. It is a level of contempt that is usually reserved for enemies in wartime, except that it is applied to our fellow citizens. Unlike criticism, contempt is particularly toxic because it assumes a moral superiority in the speaker. Contempt is often directed at people who have been excluded from a group or declared unworthy of its benefits. Contempt is often used by governments to provide rhetorical cover for torture or abuse. Contempt is one of the four behaviors that, statistically, can predict divorce in married couples. People who speak with contempt for one another will not remain united for long." That one is very, very powerful. And I think both liberals and conservatives have a lot to learn from that. Mm-hmm. From Chris Matakis, "We are the estranged orphans of our tribes, of our nations and tribes, and now we bear the weight, not of survival of the group, but of personal identity." That's a fascinating twist. And I don't even know how to pronounce this man's name, but, "I don't believe God has a darling tribe or nation. All tribes and nations are his darlings." I love that one.
And the